Tonight I'm going to talk about inner confinement or inner imprisonment, the ways that we feel imprisoned inside. And I think in some ways this is a very common experience and a paradoxical experience. Part of us knows that we should be free, we should be able to live the kind of life that we want, but we can't, you know? And, it may even be that American culture creates more dissonance because there's all this talk about, you know, we should be free and all that. And yet it's not necessarily our lived experience. And so I want to begin by telling a story, a story from, I guess you might say, literary history. When the poet Rilke was a young man, he was a very shy, diffident young man, and he was assigned to write an essay about the sculptor Rodin. And so he went to Paris, and he was actually living in Rodin's house. And you have to imagine at this point, you know, Rilke, he was in his early 20s. He hadn't started writing. He knew he wanted to be a poet, but he didn't even know how to begin. You know, meanwhile, Rodin was at the height of his powers, and he was churning out one statue after another. He had a whole team working for him, and so this just tremendous fountain of creativity, you know. And Rilke was looking at this and, you know, essentially saying, well, how do I get there from here? You know, how do I do that, you know? And he asked Rodin, and the first couple times he asked Rodin just said, you know, just work. And, you know, he didn't want to discuss it at all. Just go and just, you know, apply yourself to your work. But the third time, Rilke, he got up the courage to go back and ask a third time. And Rodin said, go down to the zoo in the middle of Paris, pick an animal, and simply watch that animal. Don't try and write about it. Just watch that animal and watch it so carefully until you can't do anything except write about it. And so Rilke went down and, you know, saw the animals, and the one that caught his attention was a panther. This incredibly powerful big cat in this relatively tiny cage, and it was just pacing back and forth, and it had paced back and forth for so long it had worn the wooden floor smooth, you know, and he just was watching it and feeling into the imprisonment of that panther. And he wound up writing a poem, and I just dropped in chat a link to this poem. It's one of his first great poems called The Panther. His vision from the constantly passing bars has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. It seems to him that there are 1,000 bars, and behind the bars, no world. As he paces in cramped circles over and over, the movement of his powerful, soft strides is like a ritual dance around a center on which a mighty will stands paralyzed. Only at times the curtains of his pupil lifts quietly. An image enters in, rushes down through the tense, arrested muscles, plunges into the heart, and is gone. And we know this about panthers, about predators in general, that they get the image of the prey and the muscles tense and then they leap, you know. And it's almost like that process starts in the panther, but it knows it cannot leap. And so then that spark dies. And what I find extraordinary about that whole story and that poem is that the way Rilke got past his block was precisely by confronting it, precisely by sitting with it and looking at it and focusing on it, you know? In other words, when he saw the panther, what he saw was the imprisonment of the panther, and looking at the panther long enough allowed him to feel into his own imprisonment. And because he felt into it so intensely, he was actually able to move beyond it. You know, why are we imprisoned? Why are we stuck and trapped in life when we don't want to be? You know, a certain amount of it has to do with trauma. Trauma is what fixes us. It's what arrests our development. You know, trauma is the experience that was too much, too soon, too fast. You know, and it, how can I say, psychologists sometimes talk about recent traumas and older traumas. You know, a recent trauma might be something that happens in my adult life. And if there's a trauma in my adult life, it tends to be a little more specific, you know, and it still can have big consequences. You know, if I have a trauma in a romantic relationship and I forswore ever being in a romance again, or I have a trauma around in a job and then I can never hold a steady job after that, or, you know, something like that. But it's the traumas of early childhood that have the most pervasive kinds of effects in our lives. And trauma held in the body is often something, it's uncomfortable. It's something we don't want to feel. It's something that the brain just tells us, don't go there, you know? And in fact, the brain might even come up with all sorts of stories about how that other person or that other group of people, they're the problems, you know? And if I get into that sort of blame behavior, you know, those other people are the problems, they're making the world bad, then I'm completely trapped. I'm hopelessly trapped, you know. And what we know about trauma, what we know about this, and exemplified very much by Rilke's process, because Rilke himself had a very traumatic upbringing. We have to sit with it. We have to feel it. We have to bring attention and mindfulness to it. And when we bring attention and mindfulness to it, that's what creates the conditions that allows it to shift. And it's very tricky because, how to say this, any place that has experienced trauma in us has been othered. And it confronts us as an other. And we have to relate to it as an other. And we have to relate to it with all the interpersonal skills we have for relating to another, you know? You know, if I go to another person and I'm looking for something, you know, I want you to change in this certain way, you know? I mean, that's very off-putting, you know? Whereas if I go to another person and I say, I'm just open to you as you are, and that's the invitation I'm extending. I'm just allowing you to be however you are. That puts people at ease, and that brings out the best of people, you know? And that's exactly the way we need to relate to our inner others, to the places that are others. Can we extend that kind of open-hearted, generous sort of acceptance, that deep allowing? You are allowed to be exactly as you are. Because sometimes it takes that complete letting go and that complete allowing for the healing to take place. So trauma is certainly one of the things that traps us and imprisons us. But of course, the paradox is that pleasure can also imprison us, you know? And, you know, of course, the most stunning examples of this are, of course, addiction. When someone's addicted, they're completely imprisoned by, you know, the substance or the behavior. But it's interesting to think about, you know, I mean, there are the formal chemical kinds of addictions. But, you know, what are the ways that we are addicted to the pleasures in our life? You know, in the moment that I'm giving myself a treat, you know, the treat that I, you know, look forward to all week, whatever it is, you know, am I really free in that moment? Am I actually freely enjoying it? Or am I the rat pressing the button in the cage to get the reward? You see what I mean? Like, am I consciously choosing to enjoy it? Or am I on automatic pilot? You know, am I present? You know, I mean, when I have the pleasurable experience, am I actually there enjoying it? You know? So it's, you know, Buddha said that just as much, you know, pleasure can be just as much a problem as pain. It's not that either is good or bad, you know, but both have the ability to snare us. From the point of view of Buddhism, it's not surprising that we walk around feeling not particularly free. You know, I mean, the Buddha's first noble truth is life is dukkha. And dukkha is a kind of imprisonment. And the cause of dukkha is attachment. And so it's interesting also how problematic our intuitive understanding of the idea of freedom might be. You know, I think if you went out on the street in America and asked a lot of people, what does it mean to be free? You get the very intuitive answer, oh, freedom means I can do what I want. You know, and there's something very problematic about that definition of freedom. You know, because we know that a life predicated on what I want, a life predicated on satisfying my desires, does not lead to abiding happiness. In fact, it doesn't lead to stability. It doesn't lead to anything particularly good, you know. And I would say freedom is something more like an inner spaciousness, a deep inner balance, a place where I am in deep balance, where I'm feeling deeply, but I'm not attached. I'm not compelled by fear. I'm not hooked by pleasure. And from this balanced place, I can mindfully choose my highest good. I think that's what freedom really looks like. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. Quote sheet is in chat there. From the Buddha, of course, no one outside ourselves can rule us inwardly. When we know this, we become free. And of course, that sounds really good. No one outside of us can rule us inwardly. And it sounds like something really wonderful. But then we get in a romantic relationship or we're with our family members and it plays out very differently. Similarly, the Diamond Sutra says, true freedom is freedom from your own desires. Rumi said, why do you stay in prison when the door is wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. The entrance to the door to the sanctuary is inside you. Goethe said, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. And certainly that's true of the person who has the addiction, who, you know, I could stop any time, and they're completely trapped by it. Freud said, most people do not really want freedom because freedom involves responsibility, and most people are frightened of responsibility. Wow, there's something deep there. Einstein said, a human being is part of the whole, called by us the universe. A part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and all its beauty. this passage from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And it's the passage, What the Thunder Said. He's quoting a passage from the Upanishads, where the thunder speaks out three words that all begin with D, Sanskrit words that begin with D. And so this passage begins with the Sanskrit word Dayadvam, which is Sanskrit for be compassionate. Dayadvam, I have heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison. Thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. And it's fascinating to think about that in terms of compassion and what compassion, the effect that compassion has in making us feel free as opposed to feeling isolated and imprisoned. Eric Fromm said, I believe that man must get rid of illusions that enslave and paralyze him, that he must become aware of a reality inside and outside of him in order to create a world which needs no illusions. Freedom and independence can be achieved only when the chains of illusion are broken. And again, sounds very heroic and all that, but boy, we're really attached to some of our illusions. Graham Greene said, it is impossible to go through life without trust. That is to be imprisoned in the worst cell of all, oneself. And it's true, all those fundamental relating skills, trust is one of the cores of them. There's so much freedom in that sense of connection and being connected with others. Viktor Frankl, who was in a concentration camp, said, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is the power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and freedom. And so this whole idea, again, that there's the stimulus and the pleasure, there I want it. Or there's the pain, I'm going to push it away. And, you know, if we can just separate between the stimulus and the response, there's power there. I think there should be and. The Buddha and all his successors warn us against the intellectual structures that confine us to an artificial environment and against concepts that smear over the living facts of things in themselves. And it's true that in many ways, if we're living in our head, that's a kind of prison. If we're living in our head, everything is logical and can make sense, but there's no vitality. There's not the raw, vital taste of being alive. And so the head can be a horrible, stifling prison, and it is for many people. Jack Kerouac said, to bow to the facts of life's sorrows and betrayals is to accept them. And from this deep gesture, we discover that all life is workable. As we learn to bow, we discover that the heart holds more freedom and compassion than we could imagine. Very powerful. Thich Nhat Hanh said, letting go gives us freedom, and freedom is the only condition for happiness. If in our hearts we still cling to anything, anger, anxiety, or possessions, we cannot be free. Buscaglia, echoing Freud's quote, says, if we wish to free ourselves from enslavement, we must choose freedom and the responsibility it entails. Eric Pervenage says, let us evade the cruel imprisonment of our mental cage and invade the explosive power of love. Only by redirecting this lost momentum to positive thinking can we re-strengthen the mold of our trust. Jack Kornfield said, freedom is an urgent, beautiful, large responsibility and a natural consequence of being human. Stephen Redhead said quite simply, you create within your mind your own cages that confine you. The poet David White said, "All of us feel as if we're in some kind of emotional or psychological imprisonment, even if it's just at the edges. Some of us feel completely imprisoned and are waiting for the world to go on. Throughout human history, there's been a long chronology of people who've been confined and who have taken that time actually to come down to another foundation and to emerge from their exile, their imprisonment, braver and more articulate than they were before they were removed from the world." And certainly an astonishing example of that in our modern time was Mr. Nelson Mandela. David Sedaris said, "Being locked up is one thing, but to have no concept of confinement, to be ignorant of its terms, and never understand that struggle is useless, that is what hell must be like." And unfortunately, there are a lot of people, I think, who live in that hell. Leonel Shriver said, "I was mortified by the prospect of hope of becoming hopelessly trapped in somebody else's story." The Eagles, in their wisdom, they tell us, "So oftentimes it happens that we live our lives in chains and we never even know we have the key." Craig Lunsborough says, "I would suggest that the prisons I incessantly create are designed not to lock me in, rather they are designed to lock the world out. And the oddity is that either way, I am a prisoner who has sentenced himself to a prison which I do not belong." And it's very interesting, you know, when we think about the ways we imprison ourselves. Am I locking part of myself in, or am I trying to lock everything that I don't like about life out? And Peter Santos says, "The spiritual freedom we seek cannot be found by grasping at, retreating to, or protecting our perceived safe spaces. Our freedom lies in remaining open continuously, not only to life's changes, but also to the divine light within us and others."